Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
The World Atlas of Cheese, Episode 2. It's a beautiful 1970s book by Nancy Erkhoff Stork, a Dutch cheese marketing expert. And we've got a beautiful sort of cheesy worldview, everything cheese. And now we're on to milking cattle. And there's a picture, a page here, beautiful 70s outset. Of about 7 cattle, a sheep and a goat. Now, let's read it. The working relationship between men and animals stretches as far back into prehistory. We cannot say with accuracy where and when the first animals provided milk for man, nor when the first oxen pulled the first load, or which animal provided the pelt to clothe the primitive human hunters. Animals once lived in the wild were first tamed and then turned into domestic helpers, into draft animals pulling carts and ploughs, and some were coaxed to give the surplus of milk that had been produced to their young. This is drunk by man and later made into cheese and butter. At a rough guess, the first animals may have been milked by the Pleistocene age about 1 million years ago. Do you like that? I don't know where they get that from. So that's before, given that man, Homo sapiens, is 200 million years ago. But he's just put that in. It's interesting to speculate whether or not mare's milk cheese was ever produced. Certainly, at one time horses were milk, but the practice has now ceased. Today, camels provide many nourishers with their milk. No other mammals can replace it in the arid desert climate. It can carry loads of up to 150 kilograms and can travel roughly 3 to 4 kilometers per hour steadily and indefatigably. It is a big drinker, drowning some 100 liters of water in a go, which can reserve for long periods. The camel gives milk for 2 years after calving, the first year to the calf and the second year to man. Sheep, too, are the ancient providers of milk and also valued for their wool and meat. In France, the Balkans, Spain, Italy, sheep are milked to make very special cheeses, such as French Roquefort, made from the milk of the famous Larzac breed of sheep, with small, intelligent heads. Do you like all those things? The lactation period during which you can be milked is generally rather short, and not more than 50 to 500 litres per annum can be expected depending on the breed. On the other hand, sheep are easily maintained and to handle, and are able to exist in rough, sparse grazing. As for the goat, it's able to live in almost inaccessible places as well in the urban communities. It too can live in sparse grazing and, if need be, has a high milk yield, the Saanen breed having one of the highest, so it's S-A-A-N-E. NEM of good quality. The milk of goats makes excellent and very tasty cheeses. Notably in France and Italy, goats are widespread in Africa, India, Turkey, and Iran. Like the camel, both sheep and goats provide milk for nomad tribes, who are often obliged to be nomadic to follow the livestock to fresh, distant grazing. The Laplanders are also obliged to travel with their migratory reindeer, which yield a quantity of milk, some of which is made into a rare cheese. A greater proportion of the world's cheeses are, however, made from cow's milk. In prehistoric times, in the woods of northern Europe, there lived herds of wild log-headed bovines, probably the ancestors of domestic cattle today. Over a long period of time, men gradually discovered the advantages of crossbreeding and thus introduced many varieties which modern stocks have descended. But crossbreeding was not the only cause of numerous varieties. Climate, soils, food, drinking water all had their influence. Also, man made use of cattle for purposes other than dairying, which was influenced their development, so that the size, shape and colour wildly diverged. The modern cow was originally indigenous to Europe before colonists introduced it to areas of the world. The colonists and their descendants crossbred according to the environment and requirements to produce either milk type, a meat type, or both. Meat stocks are found mainly on the prairies and pampas of North and South America, where they are maintained in vast herds. The milking cattle of the dairy zones require more attention than do the meat stock. The best milk producers are selected, and the yield increased by careful breeding attention to the environment of feed. The composition of milk and the various breeds differs considerably, and also the various species facts that have decided the influence on the preparation of cheeses. Milk production can only be gauged approximately. With the cow, for example, the milk yield is affected by the animal's food, whether the food comes from concentrate, maize and alfalfa and so on, or from fresh grass and rich soil. Climate has also an influence. During a rainy period, the milk yield is higher, while periods of drought, it decreases. The animal's life cycle is also important to dairymen. Towards the end of the milk-giving period, the yield falls, but the milk is richer in dry matter. The soil gives milk a certain beneficial flavours. The soil of England's Cheshire Meadows has a notable salt deposit affecting the flavour and structure of Cheshire cheese. The air contains a microorganism that end up in the milk and act on the cheese during ripening. These factors also influence that a real expert taster can often tell where the cheese has been made, provided that the milk was not pasteurised. Other milk-producing bovines include the yak, zebu, water buffalo. The yak lives high in the Himalayas, often above 4,000 metres, where it survives the icy cold and snow. For the Tibetans and some Nepalese, the yak is the sole source of milk. But on the lower slopes, where the climate is marginally more temperate, the yak is crossed with the zebu to form a hybrid chowry. The zebu, which is often found in India and East Asia and Africa, is in fact, in all tropical areas, they are called the children of the sun. They can be recognized with a large, fappy rump on the near shoulders and thick folds of skin under the necks. I can see a picture of a zebu here. There are many breeds, some good milkers, others not so productive. Crossbreeding with the best European cows produces high milk yield, but also destroys, after several generations, many of the zebu's unique qualities. Water buffaloes prefer cool bath now and then, wallowing about in thick river mud, yet they are too well adjusted to hot climates, and important milk providers in India, China, Philippines, Turkey, Egypt, and southern Italy and the Balkans. This is all while Yugoslavia's alive, Cold War's at its peak. Next chapter, the next thing is page 16, the dairy farmer's job. And there's beautiful illustrations, these black and white pictures. There's, you know, just appalling. Are they still to be found, those rustic farms where milk pails jangle early every morning and the cows are persuaded by gentle word and experienced hand to part with the milk? Are there still farms where the farmer rolls up his trousers to tread the curd, where glistening yellow cheese lies on display in cool dry cellars with a cross above the window to keep the evil spirits at bay? Milk churns can still be seen at intervals on country roads, standing like soldiers in a row, waiting to be picked up and taken to the dairy factory. So this is 1970s, it's changed there. Donkeys once churn on each side, still carrying milk to some market centres. And, way up in the slopes of the Himalayas, Sherpa women are still milking yaks to make butter and cheese. Yet change is always just around the corner, for better or for worse, depending on how you view progress. Oh, this is beautiful. One thing is certain, all over the world, the dairy farming business is changing. Many farms now have hundreds of heads of cattle. Farms are run by a new style of farm, with attitudes and abilities of corporate managing director. Animal rights. A long time ago, Horad, the editor of the American Journal, Horde's Dairyman, used to say, quote, of course, Horde, H-O-A-R-D, of Horde's Dairy Journal, used to say, treat your cows as you would want to be treated if you were a cow. When the animal becomes a merely means of production and striving for profitability can create risks that the needs of the animals are conveniently forgotten, but must not be ignored. When the cattle owner interests himself in the behavior of his herd as well as their physical characteristics, he does not have to be an ethologist to do that. Have you ever heard of that? Ethics, an ethologist. He can usually tell if they are both healthy and happy. and he will recognize that high milk yield is not the only barometer of an animal's well-being. Both as an investment in the living creature and milking animal needs and deserves proper care. Firstly, she wants a proper home, a place which is big enough, well-ventilated and clean. In some countries, the weather is so good that no stables are needed. On the other hand, on modern farms, cattle are not milked outside anymore. They are driven to a special milking shed, a milking area where the milking machine is waiting for them. In all cases, good housing is important. All milking animals needs a set regular routine and a peaceful situation during milking. Noise frightens them and the milk is held back. Yodeling, as the Swiss do, they seem to like. And the cows are very keen on cattle biscuits before milking begins. Food for thought. Secondly, animals need proper food. The modern farmer has come a long way from the comfortable, well-loved figure of the romantic novel. Even as he has the right economic knowledge, he must be sufficiently good manager to put the policy into practice. The obvious business objective is to get high price for his milk. He can only do that if the quality is also high. The right fodder and the right amounts of fodder per animal is an overriding importance. An average cow eats 60 to 75 kilograms of grass per day. That's my body weight on grass. That's enough value to yield 15 to 22 litres of milk. Some cows produce even more milk and need additional roughage and concentrates. Unless this is produced on the farm, it must be bought from the outside, thus creating cost difficulties. Fodder provides an exact balance of the animal's needs in relation to milk yield and lactation period and gestation. Research into the needs of milking animal and the properties of many foodstuffs has helped the farmer to select, from a wide variety of products, a balanced, efficient diet for his cows. This is particularly important in those cases where he does not have enough pasture land available to turn his cattle out to graze all summer. Another problem is feeding in winter, when no grass is available and moderate cool climates, an enormous quantity of good hay gathered in summer, dried in the sun, and stored in a dry place has always been essential for cattle to survive. Storage fodder in silos, an American invention of the late 19th century, is an improvement. Fodder stored hermetically sealed containers underwent a light formation process, but kept its good qualities and liked by cows. So that's a big story of the Warfarin. The important thing, however, was that the improved milk yield in winter, when the milk is scarce because many cows are in the dry period prior to calving. Besides, it's less labour-intensive than traditional methods. There is, however, the risk of foreign smells in the milk and cheese when silo feeding is not done expertly. Of course, it would be throwing money away to give a cow more fodder than it's needed for health and requirement for milk production. Water, an absolute essential, costs little in the productive dairy farming countries. In hot, arid lands, water can be very expensive quantity, affecting the entire cheese-making process from the choice of cattle fodder right through the manufacturing stages. The good economist farmer keeps a record of every animal's milk yield, fodder intakes, and other details. He selects the best milk givers for breeding. He may give a bull for the purpose, or rely on artificial insemination, which means sperm selected from the bull is introduced to the cow's uterus. Top quality cattle, when they fulfill all qualifications, are recorded in the National Herd Book. Finally, it is essential to keep cattle in good health. Over the centuries, farmers have done a wonderful job treating their sick animals as best they could, finding practical remedies and delivering calves without the help of today's specialist veterinary surgeons. But the fight against tuberculosis and the dreaded diseases such as foot and mouth disease can only be successful with the help of modern science. In poorer countries, science needs to be backed by international aid programs and voluntary professional advice. The right combination. The dairy farmer's income is dependent on milk price he obtains, but this is determined mostly by the economic factors outside his control. Since he works on small margins anyway, this economic position is a very vulnerable one. Many farmers try to diversify by looking at supporting activity, e.g. arable, pig or chicken farming, making farmhouse cheese rather than selling milk to the cheese factory is another possibility. It may be more lucrative, farmhouse cheese being much sought after, but problems are available labour and so on must be considered. Investments must be made. Cheese making and storage room must be available. And the cheese maker must be sure of sales possibilities. Would it be worth it? These and many other questions have to be closely examined before a start is made to enter successfully the cheese making profession or to continue the difficult but rewarding craft. Okay, here's a picture. It's a very interesting picture here of a cow. And it shows a heart. I don't know why the heart and veins going to its thing. It hasn't got a stomach. It hasn't got a stomach here. Oh, it's red. It's brain, central nervous system, heart, aorta, mammary artery, intestines, udder, and teeth. So it just happens. Oh, my godfather. Oh, gosh. Milk production. The udder of a cow develops under the influence of certain hormones in the animal, which is sexual maturity. But milk formation commences only after the birth of the first calf. Generally speaking, the cow is then 2 years old. In nature, milk production stops as soon as the young animal can absorb other food, but the cow is kept as a milking cattle. This lactation period lasts much longer, approximately 300 days, during which time the milk yield slowly reduces. This is followed by a dry period of some 2 months, which the cow certainly deserves. 3 months after the birth of the cow, if the cow has once again been inseminated, her body concentrates on the development of a new offspring and gathering strength for the next lactation period, which will begin after the birth of the next calf. During the first 4 days, the cow produces a yellowish colostrum. It's called breasting, or green milk, which contains everything needed to keep the newborn cow alive and start its development. In some countries, breastings is used in cooking. In Holland, it was once kept to give protective coating to Leiden cheese, but it otherwise useless to dairy purposes. After the colostrum period comes the new milk, possessing a higher than average fat and protein content, which slowly reduces. Lactation period ends with the old milk, when the fat content increases again to far above the average. Isn't that interesting? So it's colostrum. It's something that I remember from Breastfeeding Australia, but let's talk the udder or the breast, the cow. The udder consists of a left and right half separated by a masculine gland fixed to the pelvis carrying the udder. This division can be seen more clearly from the outside than the one between the front and rear quarters of each udder half is divided. There is complete separation between the four quarters. This is an advantage. For if one of them becomes infected, the three others continue to produce milk normally. Each quarter are provided with a nipple, or teat, with an opening to the end, sealed by a circular sphincter muscle. It opens by pressure, hand milking, or intermittent suction, calf or mechanical milkers. Above the teat, each quarter has a wider space, or udder system, acting as a reservoir for the milk produced. Now, this is at the receiving end of a number of channels of the milk duct. I fed numerous narrow milk capillaries and alveoli. These are arranged in clusters and bunches like grapes together in milk-producing gland tissue. Milk production takes place in the secretory cells, which are inside each of the alveoles. Is aligned. The alveolus itself is surrounded by blood capillaries, which become raw materials for milk production, are transported to the milk cells. Only a few milk components are taken directly from the blood. Most of the main components, such as fat, protein, milk, and sugar, are produced independently by the alveoli. So that's interesting. The cow secretes milk under the influence of certain nerve stimuli, which in nature mostly caused by the suction of a newborn calf. On the farm, cows are stimulated by artificial methods, such as giving them fodder concentrates or by rubbing the udders. Here, milk secretion is based, for the most part, on habit, so-called conditioned reflex. The process may even be triggered by rattling a milk bucket while starting an engine of the milking machine. The nervous stimuli travel to the central nervous system, to the hypothalamus. lipolysis, which reacts by adding the hormone oxytocin to the blood. And the same substance in childbirth contracts the muscles around the womb. Oxytocin contracts the muscles around the ovary or the udder. All the milk is pressurized out of them and it flows to the other system from which is milk. If the cow is not stimulated in this way, milking cannot take place. In other words, the cow must be encouraged to allow the milk to flow. When the animal is uneasy or frightened or in pain, however, the milk withdraws. When this happens, the effect of the oxytocin is neutralized by another hormone, adrenaline, which activates body functions such as stops milk production when milking is postponed for too long. Dairy cows are usually milked twice a day, early in the morning and late afternoon, perhaps the two most important are carefully regulated period in the routine of a daily dairy farm. Pretty amazing to see. I'm 20 minutes in. All right, we're powering in. And there's a picture of a Friesian cow. Milking by hand is an art which used to be part of education of the farm child. With the advent of milking machines, the art is dying out. Hand milking should start slowly. When the cow begins to give well, it should be done vigorously but rhythmically. Shows this woman with a cat next to it. This is a big diagram of how you put one finger, two fingers, and then pull. It's all down here. Milking and treatment of milk. Cattle are milked either by hand or machine. In developed countries, with a steady increase in the size of herds, milking by machine is a more practical method. For farmers owning animals with short lactation periods and small milk yield, like sheep and goats, a milking machine is normally too high an investment. But there are exceptions. For example, sheep can provide the milk for the famous Roquefort cheese and milk by machine because automation is an economic advantage for the Roquefort producers. Milking machines are more practical in the modern dairies since they are both expedient and hygienic. When cows are milked by hand, each stream of milk that goes into the bale is in contact with the surrounding air in the milking shed and, to a less extent, the hands of the milker. With a machine, there's little chance of this happening. Most modern dairy farms have a cooling tank to which to store the milk until the mobile tanker arrives. It is inevitable and desirable that microorganisms inhabit the cheese milk. But a high concentration of organisms can mean a risk of bad quality cheese, or both the cheese farmer and the factory. For this reason, fresh milk must remain at a low temperature, at which the microorganisms can only develop slowly. In recent years, the biochemical structure of dairy milk has been subject to considerable investigation. Oh my god, antibiotics such as penicillin may interfere with the cheese-making process, as may pesticides and residues which may be concentrated in the soil, and thus the grass upon which the cattle feed. These investigations have led to increased national and international standards governing the purity of milk. Treatment of cheese milk. For many types of cheese, the milk is partly skimmed. The creamy layer of the evening milk is ladled off. And the next day, the skim milk is mixed with the fresh morning milk. Cheese is made from partly skim milk. It has a lower fat content than whole milk cheese. Okay, there's evening milk, and you reduce the fat of it, and then you mix the two. In the cheese factory, the milk is not skimmed by ladling process, as this is too slow and costly. Instead, a separator is employed, which separates milk into skim milk and cream. This skimmed product is then mixed with whole milk until the desired fat content is achieved. The fat content desired depends on a number of factors. So you get the milk out, you've got 45% and you want to go to 30%, you get some 45, reduce that to zero and then re-add that back in. Okay, so I've actually mentioned 45%. Let's see what they read. Fat content desired depends on a number of factors, but in general, its proportions, these proportions are followed. 1% fat of milk gives cheese of 25% fat. 2.5 gives content of 40%. 3.2 gives 45% fat. Bringing the milk to the right fat content is called standardizing.
In modern factories, before the fat content is determined, the milk must be pasteurized. Few C-sharps are now made with raw milk, because many sources of contamination that exist between the cow and the factory, such as unhygienic milking, long transportation distance, wrong fodder and sick cows, all these may introduce harmful bacteria into the cheese milk, which is why the milk is usually pasteurized. Pasteurization process is named after the French chemist Louis Pasteur, who noticed that germs were destroyed by temperatures of 70 degrees and above. Apart from the harmful bacteria, the great number of other microorganisms present in the milk are also described, although the risk of turning out a defective cheese is thus largely eliminated. Some bacteria are pretty persistent. They may survive the pasteurization treatment or leave spores behind them. The spores of butter acid bacteria, for example. The type of feed may also present a problem, especially when cattle have been fed with silo fodder, for the bacteria may remain in the milk, giving the cheese a rancid taste. A disadvantage of pasteurization is that useful organisms are decimated, which tends to produce a cheese slightly more bland than the one made from raw unpasteurized milk. On the other hand, if the milk is overheated, it loses some of its natural qualities. So it is also not good for cheese making. In practice, the maximum pasteurization temperature should not exceed 75 degrees Celsius, and the milk may be held for a maximum of 15 seconds at this temperature. After pasteurization, the milk is cooled to a temperature needed for curdling. At this stage, it's said to have been pre-treated. And so here they've got different things. Milk, fat, proteins, and sugar. And milk production in years, so the cow is absolutely over it. Reindeer have a huge amount of fat. So do water buffaloes. And sheep. What's got the most protein per, you know, you'd have to go between sheep. They've got a series of useful charts at the bottom here, and they've got a thing of the different, saying they've got a roto dairy from the 70s. The principles of cheese making. The technique of cheese making consists of removing a greater part of water, which makes up the bulk of the milk, while retaining the dry matter, proteins, milk, milk fat, and milk sugar, minerals, vitamins, and so on. With this process, 10 volumes of milk can be reduced to about 1 volume of semi-hard cheese. Fresh milk is left standing long enough, it turns sour and thickens itself, producing a type of cheese that has been made for thousands of years. To make good quality cheese, which can be kept for a long period of time, a more complex procedure is called for, requiring the use of curdling agents such as rennet. So curdling is just the repulsion, removing the particle-to-particle repulsion and suspension. Rennet curdles the milk, provided the milk has been previously soured to the correct temperature, at the correct temperature. Souring is done with a special starter culture. Oh, okay, so you just can't put rennet into milk, you've got to actually sour it first. Rennet is usually obtained from the stomach back of young calves, and is stimulated by the calcium contained in the milk to convert a protein known as casein into an insoluble compound. Well, there you go. That's a bit of information. So casein is a protein, and so calcium in the milk gets the rennet to attack the casein and makes it insoluble. In other words, rennet turns milk into curd, which is the main element of cheese. Curd is a junket-like mass of insoluble dry matter, which is, before it's drained, also contains a large proportion of whey, the name for the water which has elements of sugar and mineral fat. Cheesemaker's task is to separate the whey from the curd particles, perhaps the most delicate part of the cheesemaking process. The curd must be very slowly, carefully, especially in the beginning, in order to prevent fat and curd particles escaping into the whey as it's been drained off. Okay, so it's just like blood. Can, you know, blood clotting. The separation between whey and curd is noticeable almost at once. For a fresh and soft type of cheese, the curd is hardly cut at all.
For hard varieties, it is cut into larger pieces and gradually into smaller ones, expelling much of the whey as possible. Finally, a fairly solid mass of curd is obtained, which will be dried even further before collecting into moulds and being processed. With most types of cheese, this is only half the process. Cheese requires a proper texture and flavour only after a period of curing and ripening. No two cheese types are made by exactly the same method. The endless variations are caused by differences in milk, curdling, cutting and draining, stirring and other techniques. So that's principles of cheese making. So that's basic. Rennet and curds, pre-souring, and separation of curd and whey. It's a fairly active time here. The next page, we're up to page 23, cheese ripening. One of the most important phases for cheese forming process is the ripening period. When the curd is formed and the whey is drained, the cheese remains a white mass of little no flavour. It's hard then to imagine how it could develop its delicacy. During the ripening, the salt spread throughout the cheese and the cheese loses some of its moisture, becoming more solid and containing a higher portion of dry matter with a more decided cheese taste. But at the same time, the number of extremely complicated chemical and biological processes have been taking place. Someone's put a remark there for sure, this is in the essay. In practice, the experienced cheesemaker of the past always knew only too well how they could avoid and encourage certain developments. They knew how, but they didn't know why. It was not until the 20th century that a complete picture of the complex biochemical process within the ripening cheese became available. Although microorganisms present in the cheese, the manufacturer needed useful ones and tries to eliminate those harmful ones in the character and quality of the cheese. Milk acid bacteria, very useful microorganism, and milk sugar is their favourite food, which they can use to form into milk acid. The acid levels rises eventually and makes the cheese more or less sterile, as a result of which the bacteria perish, leaving behind a protein-consuming enzyme. Casein, the most important protein in cheese, contains no less than 21 amino acids. That's like nothing. I forgot what casein is, plus many other elements. Oh dear, I forgot what casein. As the protein decomposes, the acids and elements are liberated throughout the cheese to influence the taste and aroma. Ammonia may be formed, and is a pungent odour is easily detected in some types. Milk flake is also subjected to chemical processes. A small part of it is split into by another enzyme, and resulting fat acid further contribute to the final flavour of cheese. Some bacteria living on milk sugar produce gas, which cannot escape from the paste, and so forms holes, such as characteristic for Emmental. Isn't that amazing? So that's how they form bubbles. It's the basically farts of bacteria. Apart from, I love a Jarlsberg. Okay. Apart from this natural ripening process, specific cultures are added to the cheese, perhaps to encourage the formation of white mold flora on the rind. So a mold is not a, I wonder what a mold is. Under moist conditions, an orange-red smear of Corine bacteria may grow on the surface. As the Limburger, surface ripening is usually faster than normal internal ripening, and in contrast to this, it works from the outside towards the centre. Another method to introduce a mould to the interior of a cheese, where it spreads, causing blue veining, often sharp, piquant taste, as in Roquefort. The ultimate length of ripening period depends on the cheese type. As a rule, the harder the cheese, the longer it should ripen, and also the longer a cheese ripens, the harder it gets.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.